Let's make a start. Sheet 32. We are moving stage by stage. Where's your pen? Oh, here. We are moving stage by stage to a place where we can start really getting into the Mishnah. But before we get to the Mishnah, there are just a few other things that we need to conclude with. We've had a couple of classes dealing with Tanakh, how Tanakh was formed, the different political situation and religious situation at the end of the Second Temple period. I just wanted to give you a little class on the Sfarim HaChitzonim so you know what they are. Again, one of my purposes in this course is to make you aware of issues and things that you're not going to learn anywhere else unless you definitely go away and do a Jewish studies course somewhere. But you need to know the such a things as Sfarim HaChitzonim. What are they? What are they not? How do we relate to them as in a halachic way? So have a look, please, at the very beginning. This is a useful Mishnah to know anyway. Look in source number one. Kol Yisrael Yesh Lem Chelek LeOlam Haba. It's quite a famous Mishnah. It's not mine, it's fine. But Kol Yisrael Yesh Lem Chelek LeOlam Haba, which means that every Jew has a portion in the world to come. And the truth is, the Rambam actually says that non-Jews also have a chelik in Olam Haba. Without getting into a whole discussion now, what is Olam Haba? The Rambam, of course, wrote a very important introduction. The introduction to Perek Chelek. You know what I'm talking about? Where he goes through the 13 Ikrei Hadat. He wrote in his commentary on the Mishnah, on this Mishnah, he says, I can't just give you a line-by-line commentary on the Mishnah. I have to actually give you a full introduction. What is Olam Haba? What isn't Olam Haba? What is the difference between this and Mashiach, etc. So there's a lot to talk about in terms of Olam Haba, but the starting position is that every Jew has a connection with God in Olam Haba. The Rambam says Olam Haba is our intellect, our consciousness connecting with the Shekhinah and having an ultimate, if you like, what's the word? An ultimate chibur, an ultimate connection with what the Shekhinah is in a way that we can't in this world. So that's what Olam Haba is. And every Jew has one. Doesn't mean every Jew has the same intensity. People can be closer, further away, whatever that means. We don't really understand what Olam Haba is. But we know that there is ultimately a period of our existence where we connect properly with the Shekhinah, which in this world is hard, or if not impossible. However, there are three exceptions. Says the Mishnah, there are three groups of people who have no place in the world to come. Unless, of course, they do tshuva. Everyone can do tshuva. Any moment until they die, a person can do tshuva.
Is there anything that you do that you can't?
No, there is nothing in life a person can ever do wrong that is beyond the realms of tshuva. Nothing. No one.
What about
Chayv Koris? For sure you can do tshuva. Yeah, I don't know why people seem to think that it's like once a person's got forbid Chayv Koris, it's a one-way street. Lots of people are Chayv Koris for all sorts of things. You know, it's not good, but it's the truth is there are only 36 averas a person could be chayv koris for. You can only be chayv koris if you did it on purpose, knowing what it was, realizing it was chayv koris, not caring. Chayv koris doesn't need warnings. Mises based in needs warnings. Koris just needs that you know what's going on, you know what you're doing. If a person breaks Shabbos, if a person breaks Shabbos, you're telling me they can't do tshuva? Of course they can do tshuva.
Anything wrong you do.
Anything
let's
wrong.
Let's say somebody goes around denying the existence of a shame.
Anything. Anything. Anything you can do tshuva for. The problem comes.
No one is.
There are certain people in the Torah who have their freedom of choice taken away from them. Paro. And the question is, why is that? And he had plenty of choices, by the way. He got to a point that effectively he was dead, effectively, and therefore, once you're dead, you can't do tshuva anymore.
But
and Paro, even when he was alive, he was, if you like, used as a tool.
Hashem hardened his heart.
Correct. Used him as a tool. Now he'd made all his wrong choices. Now for him, it was too late, and he was used as a tool, if you like, to run the world. For you and I, our opportunity lasts until the moment that we die, hopefully at 120, but you can't bank on that, because actually very few people ever get anywhere near that. And the point is that therefore the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, you should do tshuva the day before you die. Ah, you don't know when you're going to die, so do tshuva every day. That's why built into our Shemona Esrei is Slach Lanu Avinu Ki Chatanu. It's not just because we, you know, go around feeling guilty because we're Jewish.
That's
guilty
about everything. That's not like tshuva from the heart. It says do tshuva the day.
Well, maybe it should be. Maybe it can be.
But the thing is, you could say, this is why we don't know when Mashiach is coming. Because if we knew, let's say, when Mashiach would come, then everyone would say, okay, we can do whatever we want. We don't have to have Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. And like,
well, that's nothing to do with Mashiach. Bein Adam L'Chaveiro and mitzvahs. I understand what you're saying. I don't want to get sidetracked onto this, but just rest assured, there is no Aveira in the world that a person, Rambam says this repeatedly in Hilchos Tshuva, that there's no Aveira for which a person is barred from doing tshuva, including Chiyuv Misa, Chiyuv Koreis. Of course, a person is really Chayuv Misa and there's a Beis Din, then they'll kill him or her. And if, even if they do tshuva, well, I'm sorry, it's, you know, the tshuva won't stop you being killed, but God forbid. But these days that's not relevant, and therefore a person can do tshuva. Brady, yes.
Is there like a difference between doing teshuva for something that you get
karis
from or just regular
teshuva? Yes, the Rambam says that the teshuva for something which is chiv karis requires not only teshuva but also Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur has to be part of that process, and also perhaps even Yisurin, certain things that happen to us in life which are hard or difficult or challenging can sometimes be part of our tshuva process. And lower grade, if you like, averas, if a person, ate a piece of pork, that's less of a serious avera than if a person broke Shabbos. So the tshuva that's needed for eating the piece of pork is less intense, if you like, than the tshuva needed for Chiyuv Karis. But yes, tshuva with Yom Kippur, with Yisurin, it works. Chilul Hashem is the worst. He says, Chilul Hashem, if a person is Mechalel Hashem, then the only tshuva that works for that is ultimately the death of the person, when they die eventually. That you can't deal with during your life, if you like. So don't be Mechalel, you know, don't do Chilul Hashem. Chilul Hashem is very serious. What is Chilul Hashem? I'm not getting into right now. So anyway, these are the groups of people who have no chelik in Olam Haba. Who are these people? So he says, Ha'oimer ein tchiyas ha'meisim in ha'Torah, someone who denied tchiyas ha'meisim. That's number one. Number two, ein Torah min ha-shamayim, someone who denies Torah min ha-shamayim. And number three, an apikoros. Now, I'm not getting into what they all are now, but the Rambam, when he sets out 13 principles of imunah, a faith, yeah, whatever faith means, we don't believe in faith in the Christian sense, but the Rambam says there are 13 things that a Jew has to understand and really connect to and believe. And they are these three things, basically. He divides his 13 principles of faith into three groups. Just giving you an overview, because it's important you know this. Number one, Numbers 1 through 5 are all the way that we relate to God and understand God. That God is one, that God exists as a first cause, that God has no body, that God is beyond time, and that we pray only directly to God. These all come within the category of apikoros. Somebody who messes these up is called an apikoros. Their understanding of God is flawed. The second group of the 13 ikurim, numbers 6, 7, 8, and 9, are all to do with God's communication to man. Okay, the idea is the Torah min ha-shamayim. What is prophecy? That's number 6. Prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu is number 7. Torah min ha-shamayim is number 8. And that the Torah is unchangeable in the system. Doesn't mean that no halacha ever changes, but the system is unchangeable. They're all the second group. They're all what the Mishnah here calls Torah min ha-shamayim. And the third group of the Rambam, which is 10, 11, 12, 13, are all connected with this idea of Chiyas HaMeisim. It's Hashkocha, how God runs the world. Number 10 is that God knows everything that happens in the world. Number 11 is that there's such a thing as Hashkocha, reward and punishment. 12 is Mashiach, and 13 is? 13 is? Chiyas HaMeisim. So these three groups in the Mishnah are all the Rambam's, they're a summary of the Rambam's 13 Ikrim, or the Rambam's 13 Ikrim are an expansion of these. Okay, fine. That's nothing to do with today's shir at all, but it's good basic general Jewish knowledge. Rabbi Akiva, now here, we're interested in Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Afakoyu b'Svarim Chitzonim. Oh! Someone who reads Svarim Chitzonim has no place in Olam Haba. What does literally Svarim Chitzonim mean?
Outside.
Outside books. So what are outside books?
Everything
who's not Torah. So it means if you pick up a book of history, or chemistry, or biology, you have no place in Olam Haba. I mean, maybe it doesn't mean that.
No,
is that what it means?
No, specifically
excluded from the Torah. Like?
They're like the heretical books. Christian.
Heretical books. Ah, so if you look in the Gemara, the first pshat the Gemara gives, the first understanding of this Mishnah, number 2, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, where it picks up on this, it says, Rabbi Kiva Omer, Afakorim Sfarim Chitzonim. So the first understanding is Sifrei Minim. What a Minim? Heretics. Why the word minim used for a heretic? Who were the original minim?
Minim?
Minim. Shivat HaMinim. I'll tell you a funny story about that in a minute. But who were the minim?
The cow.
I'm surprised you don't know this. The minim was the word which were given to the early Christians. Why? Because they called themselves the Ma'aminim. Oh, you did they?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
No.
I apologize, Jessica. Just for the record, For all future, Jessica gave the answer. Just so that anyone didn't know that, forever now on the internet, as long as the internet exists, Jessica, that answer is now recorded. You gave the answer. Okay. We can give you her email address later. Okay, fine. I apologize, I didn't know. The early Christians called themselves the Ma'amim. So Chazal called them the Minim. The Christians didn't like this word heretic. Therefore, everywhere it says in the Talmud, the word min, there were Christians, there were censors through the Middle Ages that took out the word min and changed it for, do you know what? What is what the Gemara often calls when... It uses this acronym. What does this acronym stand for? Omdi Kochavim Mazalot, meaning pagans. Therefore, the Christians changed the word in the Gemara and said, we don't want you talking about us, we want you talking about the guys with blue paint on their faces. Yeah? That's not us. We are not these people. Some of the censors, and this is the point you made, Aria, which is quite funny, but you didn't think of this when you made it, some of the censors were so overzealous that every time they said the word min in the Gemara, they just deleted it and replaced it with akum. So we even have censored Gemaras where it talks about the arba minim on Sukkos. The arba akumim. Yeah, I'm serious. Just shut the door, please, Lina. And therefore, the word min means heretics. And if you look in Rashi, look at what Rashi says. What does Rashi say on the mid min? What does the word Rashi say? What does Rashi say? What does this word mean? No, in the source number 2. Galachim. What's Galachim? Who's a priest? A galach is a non-Jewish, a Christian priest. Therefore, what is Rashi saying that the Sifrei Minim are? What are these books? The Sfarim Chitzoni. It's the New Testament. It's basically the books of the Christians. Books of heretical books.
I said the Bible is a Christian.
Right, exactly. Meaning, what is it you're not allowed to read? Which are books which are written by non-Jewish heretical sects. Christianity, don't forget, started as a Jewish, an offshoot from Judaism. And you're not allowed to read these books? Rav Yosef says, no. But Sefer Ben Sira Nami Osalamikri. It's not just that. He doesn't disagree with the fact. He doesn't think you are. I'm in number 2 in the middle. He doesn't think you are allowed to read heretical books. He says it's not just that, but Sfarim Chitzonim is wider. It's not just heretical books, but even Ben Sira. Now, who was Ben Sira? Ben Sira was someone who lived in the Second Temple period. He wrote a book of Chochmah. A bit like Lahavdil Mishle or Kohelet. Why things that a person should know in getting through life. So says Rav Yosef, you can't even read that. Why not? It's not heretical. What does Rashi say? Shiyesh bo divrei havai. What's havai?
Nothingness.
Uba'aleihem avi lidei bitl Torah. So what's his concern? Meaning? To waste the time. Meaning there's two completely different understandings as far as Chitzonim. One is that it's heretical books. That's what the Issa is. They're not allowed to read heretical books. We'll try and define what they are. And the other says, look, you know, even books which are not heretical, if at the end of the day you're wasting your time, why are you learning these books? And then you get into a wider discussion that, well, do I have to all the time, every minute of my life, be learning something which is Torah? Can I ever have any... Can I take a break? Can I read a novel? That's also Divrei Havai. Can I go to a movie? So that's going to be a discussion which is not really for this class, but there's nothing heretical about that. Yes?
Does it mean that you can't study the book or that you actually can't read it?
Good. So that is really the ritzvah.
Or even can you then study it if you're doing, let's say, as in there are people who do, I'm sure there are Jewish scholars who
right.
The Old Testament in order to be able to prove it.
There are 100% are. 100%. So, for example, the Meiri, which I didn't bring you on the list, on the sheet, the Meiri says that if you're studying any of these books in order to have the ability to refute people who believe in them, or you need to understand them for positive Lashem Shemayim reasons, then you're allowed to study them, okay? Now, the people that you're talking about, the Jewish studies professors, they're studying them because they're academics. That doesn't mean that they'd be necessarily allowed halachically to study them, but there are people who would be, let's say, allowed to study them. But in your issue of... Everything all right?
Great.
If you're in your issue of just doing them now or doing them seriously or doing them for a little bit, have a look for a second at source number. Since you raised it, look at source number 4 for a second. This is a medrash. This really reaches. Is it 4? 1 second. No, it's number 3. It's number 3. It's the source coming up right now. Have a look at source number 3 for a second. Because this is, Michal, is really the point that you're making. Rabbi Akiva Oimer, Afakari B'Sfarim Chitzonim. So the Yerushalmi, when he quotes this Mishnah, the Yerushalmi says like this. Kagoyin Sifrei Ben Sira, we Zebra is the Shita of Rav Yosef, we saw before. The Sifrei Ben Lana, who was another Second Temple person, okay. By the way, there is a fascinating story of how Ben Sira was born, which I'm not getting into now because it's way off the scope of this class, and it would be more suitable for the Evan Ha'ezer class, because it goes to the issue of IVF, in vitro fertilization, which is not for now. If you can't work out how Ben Sira might be connected with IVF, then I'll tell you afterwards, because it's not for now. Aval, however, he says the Yerushalmi, Sifri Himirus, Homer. Who's Homer? Not so much a philosopher. He wrote Greek plays of different types, books of Greek ideas, wisdom. The Kolsvarim Shenichtefu Mikan VeElech. Oh, any books which are written later, so they're not included in this. Hakori Behem Kikori BeIgeres. This is like reading any old book. It's like reading Dan Brown, okay, or The Hobbit. Can you read The Hobbit? Okay, so he says Lihigayon Nitnu. They were there to dip into Liyagia. What's Yagia? What's Yagia?
Come to.
No, that with an ayin.
Arrive.
Oh yes, it is the same thing. Yeah, as in magia. Yeah, liyagia means like effort as well. Serious effort. Loi nitne. Okay, you're not allowed to take those books and really and steig. That's the best English word I can think of to translate yagia. Steig, meaning when it talks about Bittel's man, there are books that you're going to be able to pick up and down, but They're not for your main focus. They're for sometimes when you need to do something else, okay, as to range, to relax, whatever it is. That's one thing. But your focus has to be Torah. There's a whole discussion, by the way, by Rav Hirsch, which is again not for this year, on Torah im Derech Eretz. What is Torah im Derech Eretz?
It's his
philosophy on.
Like Torah.
For him, what is Derech Eretz? Can I ask you a favor? Again, lots of walking around. There's like 35 minutes, not getting at you. Just let's stay stable, okay? What's Derech Eretz? What does Rav Hirsch mean when he means Derech Eretz? Yes, exactly. Rav Hirsch understands that in order to build the platform of Torah, there has to be Derech Eretz, which is, if you like, the foundation of Torah. Derech Eretz is culture, is philosophy. Derech Eretz is languages. It's the things that a human being needs to be a human.
Yeah.
What's that?
He said he wrote his Sefer in German.
He was an extremely German citizen.
That's right. He wrote his Sefer in German, in Hochdeutsch, for the public that understood that. He Lechatchila understood. There's a big debate whether the Rav Hirsch's philosophy was Lechatchila or B'dieved, according to Rav Hirsch. Mm-hmm. Meaning, did he say this for, like, quote-unquote, Kirov, to get people involved, but really he felt that you should be sitting in yeshiva all day just learning Torah? Or did he say it because he really meant this? Okay, that's a whole discussion which I'm not going to get into right now. Let's take him on face value that he really meant this, that in order to be a high-level Jew, you have to have a foundation of Derech Eretz.
It's a high-end.
And you have, partly as well. And then you have to build on top of that a Torah. In other words, it's clear for Rav Hirsch, he says very clearly, the Torah is the ikkah, Torah is the principle, Torah is the thing which has to be the main study. But these other books, these other studies, like Homer or whatever it is going to be the side issue. It's really coming off the Yerushalmi. But it seems that this was later. Ben Sira and Ben Lana, whoever they are, at the time of Tanakh, or just after Tanakh, they seem to be more of a concern. Why? Why can't you study Ben Sira? Why who's getting a Ben Sira? He's no worse, it seems, than anyone that came 500 years later. What's the issue? So we'll see in a minute in Reuven Margolis what the issue was. Yeah.
So does that mean, according to this Gemara, that he's not allowed to do English like a thesis in under?
No, Lahatuch, it says opposite. It says the opposite of that.
You can't delve into, you can't really get into a book. If you're doing, if you're writing a thesis on let's say Paradise Lost or whatever it is,
right?
Something like that, which could indeed mean a heretical thought.
Oh no, there's two different things. Heretical books and waste of time books. Okay, so books of culture, which a person is reading in order to develop a broad cultural base, like we talked about in Torah im Derech Eretz, so you would not call that a waste of time. Okay, you'd call that a necessary part in building your structure of understanding as a Jew. Whether you should be making that your main focus, doing a PhD thesis on Milton, okay, there's going to be different people that have different things to say about that. You know, if you read the writings of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, which, by the way, we still need to go through Rav Aaron's thing, and maybe we'll do this on Thursday. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Now that you've raised it, maybe let's do that on Thursday, because I'd like to do that on Thursday. I don't want to leave you without having done that, at least this semester, because next semester I'll have in my head and other things. So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has a particular interest in English literature. And we'll be able to talk to you at great length about how important that is and how useful that is as a Jew. Heretical is a different thing. Heretical, you really, there needs to be a real good reason, a heter of some kind, while you're picking up and reading books of... And then you have to define what that means, heretical. You know, is Milton heretical? Milton's a Christian, okay. He's not writing a book to try and convince you to be a Christian. He's writing Paradise Lost, of man's first disobedience, and the fruit of that forbidden tree, and all that kind of stuff that I was forced to learn off by heart when I went to school, okay. And we did our A-levels on Paradise Lost, whatever.
And then I'm saying, like, books that are even contain deep Christianic thoughts, you're allowed to, from a literary point of view...
Right, because you're not learning them as books of religion, you're learning them as books of literature. So that'll depend on who you ask, and it's going to be a hashgraphic issue as well. In other words, not everybody agrees with this. A lot of people say that, look, this is... Forget about that. It's Torah. Torah is Torah. We saw a chazanish that people Ashrei Misha Loi Kara Sifrei Chitzonim when it came to the missing years. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
What did he mean there? He meant that, why are you reading all the secular stuff? Learn Torah. That's what you're meant to be doing. You'll get the answers out of Torah. But it seems that there seems to be a specific issue with the Second Temple period. Yes. I agree. And there'll be a major machlokas in Hashkofa. And by the way, this is not Stern College, which is Torah Omada. Torah Omada is a whole different world as well, which is you've got some kind of synthesis of Torah and Mada, which come together and sometimes make a bigger whole.
Even books about Torah bring up like secular thought.
That's true as well, and therefore you could argue you don't need to read secular books, you can read Torah books, you get everything you need. There are different hashkafas in this. This is not hashkafas shir. You have to understand in your mind, what is Torah only, what is Torah derech eretz, and what is Torah omada. Three different current philosophers in the Jewish world today who all see secular studies in different ways. You have to be able to understand and explain them. Remember the motto, girls? If you can't explain it to a five-year-old, you don't understand it. Could you explain these things that you learnt in MNY this year to your five-year-old cousin, nephew? If you can't, then you don't understand them. Okay? Yes, Jessica.
In the beginning, you said that Ben Sira is a waste of time. But if Ben Sira is so similar to Mishlei or Kohelet or whatever it is, why is
that so much? So let's look at that right now.
Then also, like, what about books that people write nowadays of, like,
that's what he calls Igeres. That's what the Yerushalmi calls an Igeres.
No, but I'm talking about, like, people who say, like, you know, wise words of wisdom from my grandmother that I've learned through my life. You know what I mean?
Good.
Those types of books.
Chochma Bagoyim. Tell me.
Why is he saying that's a waste of time?
Then? It's a waste of time if you're steig. Don't steig in the Reader's Digest book to Words of Wisdom. Read it in the bathroom and you'll learn everything you need to know. And you can steig in other things. No, isn't that what he's saying? If your main Ikka Limud is Reader's Digest, then there's what to talk about, you know. There's nothing wrong with Reader's Digest. I don't think it'd be wrong, but you can you don't have to make it your main focus. Now, number four. You can see I'm not a salesman for Reader's Digest. Do they even produce Reader's Digest anymore?
No.
Yeah, they do. No. I've not seen one for about 20 years. Oh, you get them? Exactly. Speak to Sophia. She'll tell you the right way to read the Reader's Digest. Look at number four. Amru Chachamim. Also likros besorim achatzonim. So here's a medrash. You're not allowed to read besorim achatzonim. So what does it say? Shinema kemasmerot netuim. It calls the words of Chochma masmerot. What's a masmer?
Isn't it like a garden?
A nail.
Yeah, it's a nail. It's a nail. And we saw this quote when we talked about the Vale Asufos. It's where we talked about Elu Ve'elu. We talked about that length. So now there's like a little play on words, like an asmachta. Ma mishmarot, masmerot mishmarot. It's the sin and the shin. Ma mishmarot akohen emeshim va'arba. Just like there are 24 mishmarot. Afsfori emeshim va'arba. Meaning it's telling you have to read the 24 books. Don't get out of the 24 books of Tanakh. Don't start reading the other books. What's going on here? Again, it associates them with Sfarim Chitzonim. So I just want to mention this very interesting piece by Rav Reuven Margolis. Rav Reuven Margolis wrote a Perush. Who was he? He was a very interesting Rav. He lived in Israel most of the 20th century. I brought a little picture of him on the back. You had him once before. You had a picture of him once before, if you remember, way back in seat number 7, 8, 9, something like that. He lived in Yerushalayim, in Israel, in Eretz Yisrael, and he wrote a very famous commentary on Sanhedrin. And this comes from Sanhedrin, this whole sugya, and therefore he writes in number 5 the following. There are whole books of what we call the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha, which I'm not getting into detail in them because I already mentioned them and I really said pretty much enough about them. But if you look at the back, let's look at the appendix for one second, please. Please look at the appendix. There's a list of books here that are all books from the Second Temple, late Second Temple period. Now, these are books, some of which appear in the Catholic Bible, we said that last time, and some of which are books written by Jews in Hebrew, which are used by Chazal, etc. Books, for example, like the Maccabim, Sefer HaMaccabim, Maccabim 1, Maccabim 2, gives a very strong account of the whole Hanukkah story, and people use that and refer to that. Some of them are quoted, we'll see soon, by the Rishonim. Some of them are quoted by Chazal. Some of them... there's like a continuation, there's a second part of Megillas Esther that picks up on in 10.4, which is, no, that is not seen by Chazal as being a legitimate source. It doesn't come anywhere in the Jewish writings. Again, the book of Esther is written as a book of Ksuvim, with Ruach HaKodesh. It wasn't written with Ruach HaKodesh. Whatever historical statements it makes cannot be relied on because the Ruach HaKodesh is not there.
But why do you need Ruach HaKodesh in order to write down history?
Because the book, this is, how many times do I need to say this? The books of Tanakh are not books of history. None of them.
They're books of Chokhmah. Why this one as a book of history?
Because then you have to ask, is it historically accurate? I don't know. You have to go to the academics and work out whether it's historically true, historically not true, who wrote
it. That's a short show with this idea.
Many of these books...
I disagree that Torah is not a historical...
It obviously has historical framework. Esther and Mordechai lived in a place called Shushan with a king called Ahasuerus. These were real people. We know that.
No, I'm saying...
But the book itself is a book of Ruach HaKodesh, which I'm reading not in order to learn what happened and when, but I'm learning
Judaism, like the religion, basically Judaism, when you prove it, it's a historical fact.
Yeah, I'm not denying that. I'm absolutely not denying that. But I'm saying the reason I study Judaism is not to learn history. It may well be that I can study other books to learn history, but then I have to go to a history professor and ask him, is it true or not? If a history professor turns around to me and say, I don't think that the books of Tanakh are historically accurate, which they might well do, that doesn't matter to me at all. Why do I care? I'm not learning them for history.
It doesn't matter if someone's disputing it. It's still a historical book. Regardless of dispute, you could say that. I could just say...
We don't follow you. We follow this one. Follow that. Exactly. And by the way, the historians don't have... You can never prove what happened in history. We talked about this. You can never prove it. You can dig up this and you can dig up that. You can have this thesis and that thesis. But historical truth is never going to be 100%, because you could always dig up something else next week which is going to indicate the there's a massive debate going on as to what was King David in the academic historical sort of university world. What did King David's world look like? Was there even a King David, they asked?
Can I draw a picture?
Red hair, curly, you know, whatever. So you can meet some academics that say, we don't think, you know, King David existed, or we think if he did exist he had a small, like little kingship in Yerushalayim, but it wasn't a big... But then they dig up things, for example, they've dug up things which seem to indicate very much, very different to that. There have been recent discoveries over the last year, 2 years, of things from the time of King David that indicate a much bigger Malchus, a much bigger picture, much more similar to the one that we see in Tanakh. And then all of a sudden the historians have to start reassessing. Do we accept that? Do we not accept that? So don't put too much credence on archaeology and things like that, because it'll all change over the next few years. So yes, Rachel is right that our books of Tanakh are historically relevant. But at the end of the day, I maintain that we're not learning history from them. We're learning Judaism from them. Yes.
So if we want to have like a background to what was going on at the time, like... People, you don't hear about people having like the Apocrypha on their shelf.
No, you do not, although some do. I heard a wonderful story of a shidduch from America's
Hebrew?
You can buy them in Hebrew. That's one of the issues. Many of the Apocrypha books were originally written in Greek, or were only preserved in Greek, and were only preserved by the Christians, meaning we never had the original Hebrew. So what we had in Greek was Christian-influenced, books, which could have been edited. You know what the Christian faith really wants to try and find indications within the books of Tanakh to their own religion, understandably, and therefore these books were not reliable, the Apocrypha were not reliable, because we didn't have the originals, we didn't know what they were. Now, by the way, we have found some of the originals. Some of the original Apocrypha have been found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's one of the things that was discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
So you could say that our Tanakh is unreliable because the Christians were the ones that made up the Prakim and they divided.
No, the Prakim is just a division of the Psukim. They didn't change the words. And they didn't even make the Psukim. They just divided the Psukim into chapters. There's nothing unreliable about that. We don't have the Tanakh from the Christians. God forbid. We have the Tanakh from the Tanakh. It predates the Christians by hundreds and hundreds of years.
But if we don't want anything to do with them, then why do we keep the Prakim the way they are?
Okay, we had this discussion last time. There are, in the Koran edition of the Tanakh, there are some who try to make the Prakim like according to a more Jewish way of looking at things. But we don't need to be so fanatical. You know, the Prakim doesn't really change anything in terms of the meaning. So that's one of the reasons why the Apocrypha was less used, because we didn't know if it was reliable. By the way, today, do you find Jewish people who talk about this? Did you ever talk about this at school? Some of you did, Jessica did, because she had a good historical background. If you go to the Gush, you'll see the slightly more academic side of Jewish Limud HaTorah. They'll know all about this. They'll talk about the Sefer Yovlim, and the this, and the that, and the this, and the... There's no, God forbid, there's nothing heretical going on. If you go to the more yeshivish crowd, then they won't talk about these at all, because they're not interested. So, but they're out there, and you'll see in a minute that Chazal actually referred to them. Rav Ruben Margolis makes the point in this long source that I hope you read at the very end. He makes a very interesting point, which is this. At the time of when they were putting together the Tanakh, there was much more of a concern that people were going to try and slip these books into the Tanakh. He asked a question. Chazal referred to Sefer Ben Sira. They refer to it. So how can they refer to it when it says it's Sforim Chitzonim and it's also to read it and you have no place in the world to come? How does that work? So he explains, if you read the source, I'm sure you got this at the end. He says that at the time, just one second Shandy, at the time of the Second Temple, there was more of a concern that people were going to confuse these. When the Tanakh was being finally put together, the last books of the Tanakh. So someone's going to want to slip in, oh, well I think Sefer Ben Sira should be in the Tanakh as well. There was a concern, so they said that you can't study these books. But later, he says, by the time of the Tanaim, by the time of the Amoraim, there was no such concern anymore. The Tanakh was closed, it was finished, it was there, it was done. And therefore, you can now study the books, obviously not the heretical ones, because then there's a different shaila. Are you allowed to read the heretical books? That's a different, separate shaila. But there's no concern anymore that you're going to confuse them with Tanakh. That's why Sefer Ben Sira and others come in later. Just look for a second, look at people who refer to them. Have a look for a second in number 10 and 11. Just skip to 10 and 11. Two quotes from the Ramban. The Ramban on Chumash, in number 10, he says as follows. Umurgalhu af b'loshon arami. He's talking about things which are said in Aramaic. I'm not getting into the exact context. Kamoy shekasef, as we see written, b'megillat Shoshan. What's b'megillat Shoshan? The book of Shoshana. He's referring to the book of Susanna. Susanna is the English word for Shoshana. Actually, the quote that he's bringing is from the book of Judith. Okay, so there's a... What exactly is it? The book of Susanna is the book of Judith. That's fine. But he's referencing one of the books of the Apocrypha. If you didn't know what this was, you wouldn't know what it was. Look what the Ramban says in the beginning of the Hizakdom in number 11. Ra'isi, I've read B'Sefer HaMaturgam, a translated book, Hanikra, which is called Chochma Sarapsa the Shloima, the great wisdom of Solomon. The cost of buying it's written in that book. What is that book he's referring to? He's referring to a book called The Wisdom of Solomon, which is one of the books of the Apocrypha, which is not included in Tanakh, but the Ramban feels that he knows about this book, he wants to quote from it. By the way, the Ramban was quite interested in a number of occasions on the archaeology of things and the historical nature of things. Remember we saw the Ramban at the coins?
Yep.
Remember that? When the Ramban made the Aliyah, he said he found these coins in Akko. And he went to compare. We talked about this on Shabbos, if you were with me on Shabbos. And he went to get these coins, went to the Samaritans. Also, on last week's Parsha, I mentioned the Shabbos table this week. He says, you remember there's a whole thing where Yosef speaks to the brothers. He says, and you know it's me, kipim and that, because it's my mouth speaking. What does Rashi say there? What proof is Yosef bringing? I know you know, because it's just on Shabbos. Does anyone else know? It says in the Pasuk. What would yes I do in a minute if no one else does. What would Yosef be trying to prove when he says I'm speaking to you?
You know my voice, you recognize my voice.
Oh, so but why did he change his voice before? He spoke with a high voice or a low voice? If they knew his voice, they knew it before. So what's different now?
He spoke Hebrew.
Oh, That's Rashi. So Rashi says now he spoke Hebrew.
I told you I'd get it.
Yes, sir. The Ramban, because you have a good Jewish education, that's why.
I do.
The Ramban comes in there and says, this you won't know. If you do, that'll be really
I learned Hebrew Yosef last year.
Oh, no. So the Ramban comes in and says that I don't agree with Rashi. Why not?
Because
the Canaanite
wasn't speaking.
Right, everybody spoke Hebrew. Hebrew was the language of the Canaanite people.
So then why do they need a translator?
Because in Egypt, you don't use the language of a foreign people. You speak Egyptian because it's the Egyptian court.
Then why would they need a translator?
Because again, it's not covered for the king is going to start speaking in every language of every person. But to say that Yosef, who is the head of the government, didn't know Hebrew?
He knew all languages.
Okay.
That was known.
Okay, so that was Paro, by the way. So what proof is it that Yosef is speaking Hebrew if everyone knew the languages? That's the question Kashri has on Rashi. So he said, actually, it's not me. He doesn't mean that. He means it's me, Yosef, I'm the head of Egypt. I'm saying I wouldn't say, what have I got to gain if I'm lying? You know, kind of thing. It's a political statement more than anything else. Not political, but it's trying to convince the brothers. I'm just saying that the Ramban is interested in making the statement that the people in Canaan spoke X language at the time, and therefore this pshat cannot be read. That's what he said. It's actually quite an interesting statement.
Yeah.
Have a look at that Ramban afterwards. He says, the people in Canaan spoke biblical Hebrew at the time of Yosef.
Everyone freaked out when we tried to bring in modern Hebrew.
Not the people of Egypt, but the people of the non-Jewish Canaanim. Therefore, Yosef knew Hebrew because you would expect him to know Hebrew. Because he would know the language of the people that live right next door. Americans only speak one language.
I can't see President Obama speaking French.
I agree with you, but I bet you'll find that most European leaders speak a number of other languages.
Okay, sure.
I'm not getting into President Obama now, otherwise we'll never go anywhere else. Please can we turn over and have a look at this. Have a look in number 7. The different beforeshim, therefore, when it comes to Sforim Chitzonim, I wanted to get some clarity here. There are a few issues going on. Number one, there's this issue of Tanakh and being concerned about sealing Tanakh and the people getting confused with Tanakh. But later on, it becomes less of a problem. So we saw the Ramban quotes from different books of the Apocrypha, and people learn them today. Some of them are still heretical. Okay, fine. So we don't learn those. But the ones that are reliable or helpful, then we do. If you look in number 7 for a second, the Rivash, who's in Spain in the Middle Ages, he says, Rabbi Kiva Oimer Af Karev Sforim Chitzonim, Amru Gemara, the Gemara says, Tani is Smith Sifri Minim. He goes down the heresy route. And he says, Hayesh Sifrei Minim Yosem Elu, are there any worse Sforim than these Sforim from the Apocrypha, from the Second Temple period? Shemevim Moisim Varias, they bring proofs and miracles and all that. I think he's talking about the New Testament actually as well. Okay? The Hachish Ikri Torah, they try and disprove the Torah, meaning these Sforim which are written by people that wanted to try and break away from Judaism, for sure he says you have a problem. He understands that as being the real issue. The Amar Rabbi Akiva Hamami. Okay. He didn't say people who believe them, even people who just read them, even reading these books, he says, and by the way, that's in halach as well. It's not so posh in halach you can just read anything you like. There are books that you need to ask a shayla: is this book appropriate for me to read, who I am, for what I'm reading it for where I'm standing, yeah, that's for sure. But I'm not talking about Kabbalah, I'm talking about the opposite extreme. I'm talking about books which are written from a non-Jewish perspective. Now again, I wouldn't go so far as to say you can never pick up anything which is not written from a Jewish perspective. If you want to read history, you know, you don't have to just read the art scroll version of history. There are other books which will help as well. But it's a question at a certain point. You can't read just everything. Penyata es levavoy peni, they might move your mind in a different direction. Lahamin, but if rain to believe them, kamosha kari la least. As happened to Elisha Acher. Who is Elisha Acher? You read up all about him. I saw in the Beit Midrash.
I wrote my essay. He was a guy. He was basically the Rebbe Tom of Bethlehem who read these books, and then he went off, and then his student wanted to ask him questions, and they were walking on Shabbos, and then he's like,
who was his student?
Rabbi
Meir.
Meir.
Okay.
He's walking on Shabbos, and his student, and at one point he was out of words, and his student was walking next to him, and at one point he said, sorry, like, you can't come any further past the club.
Okay.
And he's like, how do you know? He's like, well, I was counting, and it got to 1,000, I think. 1,000.
Okay.
And whatever. And
he was counting the Amos. 2,000 is the tum. Okay.
And then he's like, why don't you like do teshuva? And like our man said, like, why don't you do teshuva? Like, you're so smart. Like, why can't you do teshuva? And he said that you're a boskel. Come out from a close confession, but Rabbi Lerner also said that wasn't necessarily true, that he didn't ask you for a gospel.
I thought Rabbi Meir was his teacher.
No, Rabbi Meir was his student.
And then he saw
he was a chaver. Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya was a chaver of Rabbi Akiva. Arba nichnasu
lepardes. Oh, his teacher was Rabbi Yehoshua.
Yeah. And the question is, why did he become a heretic? And what kind of heretic did he become?
Because he studied too much into.
So there's a number of different.
Their kids died.
There's not necessarily Rabbi Meir's, but he saw things that made him question. He saw a kid doing kibbut avaim, climbing a tree, doing shluach hakam, the two mitzvahs that the Torah says you will have a long life, and the kid died, and he says, like, how does Torah work? You know, in other words, he had certain emotional crises as well. It also talks about his upbringing. He was given a very broad secular upbringing. He was into Greek stuff and into Sifrei Minim and all, and he also had a bit of a taiva for other things, but he was into the whole wine, women, and song stuff as well. We talked about that before, didn't we? We didn't talk about that.
Yeah. Have you read the book As a Driven Leaf?
I have read the book As a Driven Leaf. Have you?
I wrote about him for my Midrashah essay.
It's a very interesting book. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. The book is, you know what I'm talking about? There was a book written by a Reform rabbi. Steinberg?
Milton Steinberg.
Steinbeck. Called As a Driven Leaf, about the life of Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya. Or Elisha ben Abuya. He's maybe lost his smicha, whatever. The book is more about the life of Milton Steinbeck, really, and his own struggles with issues. And I found it actually quite a disturbing book in many ways. It was an interesting book, but it was not a straightforward read. And I don't know how historically true it is either. It's a book of fiction.
I enjoyed it for what it was worth.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting book. It makes you think. But not every book that makes you think is necessarily worth reading. But Elisha ben Abuya was a real historical figure, one of the greatest heretics that Judaism's ever known. There are those, by the way, that suggest he became a Christian, which actually fits a lot with what happened. It doesn't say that in that book, but I heard that in the name of a big Talmud Chacham.
How does Christianity have less questions?
Less what? Doesn't have less questions. It's just a different kind of system. But he fits exactly the time of the early Christians, and that's exactly the stuff that was going on at the time. Unlike Menachem that we learnt about, who went off, he couldn't have become a Christian, he was far too early. Yeah. It could be that Elisha ben Abuya did become a Christian, whatever. So he's saying reading books of Sfarim Chitzonim is not such a big mitzvah, even if you want to be a broad educated person. So he's stressing the idea that there are things which are a problem. Yes.
Wasn't there also a guy Menashe? He was he was a really bad king.
Yeah, but that's miles before. That's
no,
a long
no,
time.
But that he was very smart and he knew everything. And there was somebody that was teaching a class and he couldn't answer a question. He came to him in a dream and he said he gave him the question and he couldn't answer it, and then he answered it. And he said, "So I don't understand." And
why were you so interested in Avodah Zarah?
If you're such a huge Talmud Chacham.
Yeah. So
he said that if you would have been, you would have picked up your things. You would have Avodah Zarah. Not everybody who even believes in it doesn't mean that they, like, just because somebody's very smart. Like, I don't like these questions. Like, oh, just because you're so smart and because you understand whatever.
What are you asking me?
Like, why did this student say to him? Oh, if you're talking about Torah in a logical manner, you can't talk about Torah in a logical manner. Like,
why?
Because it's not logical.
Torah's very logical.
But you're saying it's not history, it's not historical.
I'm saying that you don't have to treat it like history, and you shouldn't treat it like history. I'm not saying it's not logical. There's a completely different discussion. Torah is very logical in many ways. It doesn't mean that everything has a logical answer, but it is a logical system, for sure.
So then why don't these people who are so smart understand it so well?
There are very clever people in the world who are Jewish, and there are very clever people in the world who are Catholics, and there are very clever people in the world who are atheists. Why people choose a certain religious lifestyle is a very complicated question, which is not just about how clever they are. It's about their background. It's about, why is it that most of the people in the world who are born into one religion stay in that religion? Why isn't there a mass switch around at the age of 20 and everybody's thinking about what they are? And half the Muslims become Christian, half the Christians become Jewish, and half the Jewish people. Why doesn't that happen?
No, I'm not asking about modern day. I'm talking about these people who were so smart and such Talmidei Chacham.
People were always people. People always had emotional, intellectual, psychological challenges of different types. Always. It's not nothing's new today. What's new today?
Yeah.
People always had issues, family, baggage, personal problems. People always have to deal with a complex range of human emotions, and that has an impact on religion today. One of the reasons that people were religious or not religious then, so many of those reasons are still very relevant today. The idea that we live in a world in which nothing is in common with what happened 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, it's not true. Much of the human condition remains the human condition, which is one of the reasons, by the way, why it's still valuable for us to read literature from 1,000 years ago. because people dealt with the same issues that they deal with today. Kal v'chomer, Torah, people dealt with the same issues that they do with today. I don't mean everything's the same. Obviously, some things are different, but most things are the same. Yes.
If we did want to study these books between our Hebrew Rambam and all the different quotes from them,
yes.
Where would we find them? Are they Hebrew texts, or would we have to go to the...
Well, that's the thing. You'll find them in a Catholic Bible, but you might not want to read them from there because
right,
that's taken from the Greek translations.
Are there any Jewish publishers that publish them?
Yeah, you can buy a set of books called Sforim Chitzonim in Hebrew.
And that's okay to purchase?
Yeah, so it's okay to buy that?
Oh, so that depends on who you ask. It depends on why you're buying them and what you're doing with them. Are you reading them in...
Where do you buy them from? Does Mossad Rav Kook publish them?
Yeah, as it happens, Dafke Israel, I think it is Mossad Rav Kook that publishes them. I don't want to say that. That's not true. Where did I pick up my copy? I can't remember where it was, but it was somewhere. Maybe it wasn't Mossad Rav Kook, but it was somewhere like that. I'll check when I go home. But it depends. You can get them. It depends on what you're using them for.
Rambam, he quotes that you want to read outside and see
right.
You quote them from, so you want to see the outside source. Where would you?
I mean, the most obvious place to find it would be online, but you have to know where you're, what you're reading. And what
is it? Okay, like other publishers who now publish it.
Yeah, but not necessarily. Yes, there are.
If you want to know the Hanukkah story, how would you?
Yes, you can get Sefer HaMakabim quite easily.
How would you know it?
You go to a Jewish bookshop and you'll there's something called Megillat Antiochus as well, which is published as well as Sefer HaMakabim. We get it from there, but you'll find it in the bookshop. Go if you go to what do you call it?
Those are legitimate. No, I don't know.
How do I know the story because my kitchen talks to me? But how do we originally know this?
I think they got a lot from Sefer HaMakabim, quite frankly. A lot of stuff came down, a lot of stories came down from Sefer HaMakabim. It's just they weren't using Sefer HaMakabim, it's just these are the stories about Hanukkah that everybody knows. But Sefer HaMakabim is a source that people have had for a long time. Yeah.
So we're allowed to read it to get the real...
I think you're allowed to read Sefer HaMakabim for sure.
That's but, legitimate.
Yeah. I mean, I'm saying it's not a book of Tanakh. Don't think it's a book of Ruach HaKodesh.
No.
But if you want to know the story of Hanukkah, I think if you ask most people a Shaila, am I allowed halakhically to read Sefer HaMakabim? I think most people would say yes. Don't maybe make it the ikkah part of your learning, but yeah, sure. I just wanted to show you a couple more things. And then we must, I want to talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls for 2 minutes and then I want to go. Have a look, please, second at 8 and 9. 8 is the Radvaz, which is giving you one of the reasons why we don't read some of these things because of their unreliability. Rabbi Akiva Oimer Afakud Bisfarim Chitzonim, Upeshu Gemara Mai Chitzonim Sifri Minim, Perishashi Sifri Galachim, Hoylech Lishitasa Shikari Bechol Makam Min Talmud Yeshu, Talmud Yeshu. Who are the Minim? Are the Talmud Yeshu? Who was Yeshu?
Jesus.
Yeah, Jesus. Therefore, he's saying that one of the problems is the Christian influence on these Sfarim Chitzonim, which maybe, Michal, now we're able to weed out a bit if we've got the original books and we can start looking at where they were in the original. Look at the Ritva for a second, number 9. Again, very interesting. Says the Ritva, what does it mean, Ben-Sira? Perish va'afal pisha karohu b'sanhedrin seif Sfarim Chitzonim. Even though Ben-Sira, which is quoted in the Gemara here in Bava Basra, is called Sfarim Chitzonim. Shema minah shaloi asru el al asris memenu keva. He's getting at the idea of don't make them a keva. In other words, these books which are not heretical, like Ben Sira, don't make them a fixed thing. Aval royal agos boy beitzos, you can look at them occasionally. Little bit of a chachma musa, you can learn chachma, you can learn musa. Masha enkim sifrei minim, but if they are mamish heretical books, you can't. And when the Rambam talks about this, look at number 12 for a second. Go over to number 12. The Rambam is more focused on the issue of wasting your time. The came sifrei Ben Sira, shehaya ish. Okay, Chabas Sfarim. Yeah, he was Machabas Sfarim. He wrote Sfarim. Baziot Be'inyane Al-Farasa. I'm not sure what that is exactly. She'ein Behem Chochma. He says he doesn't think there's any point reading it. The Loita Eles. Ela Ibud Hazman B'dvarim B'talem. Says the Rambam, really, what the Rambam thinks that the Halacha is trying to get at here, this Sfarim Chitzonim, is don't read stuff that's going to waste your time. He says you can buy lots of books in Arabic. Today, read novels and things like that. Again, I'm not telling you it's also to read a novel. I'm telling you that at the end of the day, you can't treat them the same way as you treat books which are of real essential value. I mean, Hagia Malachim, the stories of politics, of kings, you know, reading the newspaper and all that kind of stuff. It says that these, at the end of the day, are not going to be stuff that keeps that you're going to make the ikkar of your learning. because they shifte aravim, the sifrei hashirim, books of poetry, ukiyotze behem in asfarim she'ein chochma behem. At the end of the day, if there's no chochma in the loyta eles gashmit, okay, elo ibud asman bilvad. Watch out, he says, of reading things which are ibud asman bilvad. And therefore, I think there are two. In summary, there are two real focuses on this forum concerning. There's the Harel three. There's the apocrypha, whether they form part of the canon of Tanakh angle, which is less of a problem today because Tanakh is well settled and no one's going to get confused anymore. There's the heretical angle, which is relevant. You have to work out what are the books about, what are you getting from them, are they coming through a filter which is not reliable. And then there's the wasting of time angle, which is, what am I doing with this? Is this my main limud? Am I doing a PhD in this? Shouldn't I be? What hashkafa do I follow? Terum derech eretz, terum mada, yada yada yada, which is going to influence the way that you relate to all those things. Just a word for a second at the end, in the last 5 minutes, on the Dead Sea Scrolls, I've mentioned them a few times, but this is really exactly the period that we're dealing with here. I brought you a picture on the back of the Isaiah scroll. I brought you the beginning of it. You can see the writing, Chazon Yishayahu Min Amotz, the beginning of the, that's the script that it's written in. You can go to the shrine of the book and you can see a copy, a facsimile, if you like, of the Isaiah scroll in that big round thing in the middle. You know what I'm talking about? In the middle of the shrine of the book there. You can see a couple of pages of the actual scrolls. One of the fascinating things of the Dead Sea Scrolls is that, as I said to you before, we found thousands of fragments of text going back to like the 3rd, 4th century BCE. Many of these were books of Tanakh, and by the way, many of the versions that we find of Tanakh are very, very accurate to the Tanakh that we have today, which is very, very interesting.
When did the Essenes
though? We don't know exactly who they were. The books that we found in the Dead Sea Scrolls were in three groups. Some of them were books of Tanakh that they just copied and were using as Tanakh. Some of them were books of apocrypha type books of other books from the Second Temple period that they were using and reading, and some of them were the rules of their sect and the rules of their, you know, their people, which are interesting for the reasons that we talked about before. They write letters to Yerushalayim saying, you know, we do this, you do that, all that kind of stuff. But what's really fascinating is that they open up a whole world of textual, you know, analysis that we didn't have until we found them. And the question is, what else is there out there that we haven't found? It's hard to know what you haven't found. You know, it's hard enough to know what you have found. And there was a lot of controversy, by the way, or controversy, whatever you say, I don't remember now. When the Dead Sea Scrolls were first found, they didn't let Jewish people study them. The academic team was designed so as to exclude a lot of the Jewish scholars. So a lot of the early scholarship on the Dead Sea Scrolls was done by Christian scholars. There was a lot of politics involved. They were found in an area which became Jordan and was not Israel. There was a lot of fear of what this would say about early Christianity if it got out. And there was an incredible amount of political stuff going on. Any book that you buy about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I suggest that you, there's some really good books out there, we'll talk a lot about the politics of the academic side of things. Now the whole thing is opened up, it's even online. You can go to the digitized Dead Sea Scrolls.org, okay, and you can read them. But even today this is a political issue. Why is it political? Because there are those people who claim the Palestinians should have the Dead Sea Scrolls because the area in which they were found was part of what is intended to be a Palestinian state.
Jordan.
Okay, but you know something? All sorts of countries. Hello? All sorts of countries have all sorts of things that have nothing to do with their religion.
Better ear.
You know, wow. There's lots of stuff, Jewish stuff, which is in Turkey. There's lots of Egyptian stuff, which is in the Israel Museum. Once you start saying, well, this should belong here, this should belong there, you open up a can of worms that most people don't want to open up. Okay, that's enough of that. We'll move on next time. Be, Hashem.